podcast this week, we are back to black with back to black star, old Amy Winehouse herself, Marisa Abella. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has a 50-50 chance of living, though there's only a 10% chance of that. Hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This is our first podcast officially in the brand new studio. Hooray! Woo! Woo! Yay! Exciting times for everybody. The everybody is/are?
Everybody's are?
Everybody is or everybody are? Everybody is. Kind of everybody are. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Great big fucking nerd James Dyer is here.
I have returned.
You have returned?
From yes. Where?
I have returned. Obviously, I've been in hiding for the past week after Helen's murder attempt. So I was forced to, A, recuperate and regather my strength, but also stay in hiding lest she return to finish the job.
What do you mean murder attempt?
This would be the incident. Those who listen to the Pilot TV podcast will already know this story.
But that's four people.
At so the end of...
The people who don't listen to
the
that.
Final tour show in Salford, Helen, after suffering 5 weeks of dune splainings, took the opportunity to try and end my life with a car boot, the weapon of her people.
Good to see what happens on tour, stays on tour.
Vehicular manslaughter, that's what I was
going for. That's it, yeah, yeah. She slammed the boot of what looked like an Audi Q5 on my head.
Yes, and I can see, wow, my God, you're disfigured.
This is a scar gained in battle with my mortal enemy, to wit, you.
Wow. I am the scar giver.
You are the scar giver.
Suck it, Snyder Bros.
You were wearing the smallest Band-Aid I've ever seen.
It was a small plaster. It was a small passive-aggressive plaster to show the world how I had been mistreated by Helen.
I can't see an injury
Can I see an injury. I can only see an emotional injury. Have you called injurylawyersforyou.co.uk?
I should, shouldn't
Have
I?
You suffered an injury in or adjacent to the workplace?
As our lawyer, Helen, could you represent me in the case against you? is that a conflict of interest?
Objection.
I think that would be fine.
No, I don't see any conflict of interest there.
The defendant is clearly incompetent. This is a case of mens rea, if ever I saw one.
Wow, you still don't understand that.
Still don't understand it. And you know what? I never will. Anyway, welcome, welcome, welcome. Also in the fourth chair this week, someone who hasn't been grievously injured by one of our team, it is Alex Godfrey. Hello, Alex Godfrey.
Yeah, I haven't been hideously disfigured. I just always look like this. This is my face.
What's the most grievous injury you've suffered, Alex Godfrey?
I had appendicitis.
Okay.
Nearly died.
Good. Yeah.
Is that an injury, though?
That's exciting.
Yeah, my body
turned on you.
Itself.
Define nearly died.
I was 8 years. Do you really want to hear my life story?
No, not really, but this one bit in a very, very short version of it, yes.
I was 8 years old. I woke up 4 a.m. In agonizing pain, and my parents took me to hospital. They didn't know what was wrong with me for 2 days. They kept inspecting me. They couldn't find anything. And they finally just went, all right, we'll just slice him open. They sliced me open. They found my burst appendix on the wrong side of my body.
Whoa.
And they said, let's get rid of this another day, and he might have been dead. And also, we need to check where all of his other internal organs are, because there are cases where some people's entire organs are on the wrong side of their body.
They're kind of like flipped around, aren't they?
Yeah, but it turned out it was just my stupid appendix, which they got rid of, and I lived to become a casual podcaster.
There we go. Exciting stuff.
You Helen, did ask. I did ask.
I'm very, very sorry. Helen, apart from obviously trying to kill James with a car boot, what's the worst injury you've ever inflicted upon someone?
Inflicted upon someone else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, they were worse than splitting someone's head open.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's bad enough, isn't it? You know, didn't enjoy that.
Is the Statue of Libertations finished on this?
Let's say yes. Yes, the Statue of Limitations.
Oh, I thought it was the Statue of Libertations.
Was merely a week.
There's a reason why Alex is sat between us right now. I'm just saying.
He's a peace wall.
Yeah.
Like the one you and I always have to carry around with us, Chris.
Wherever
Chris and I go, we actually carry a piece of wall.
I'm like a wrestling referee.
Yeah. Keep us apart.
There'll be none of that. So. Let's get ready
to rumble, though, shall we? James, I won't ask what the worst injury you've ever inflicted or sustained is, because I'm looking at it right now. I can't take my eyes off it.
Yes.
My God.
It's deeply upsetting.
What are you going to do about that, whatever it is?
Yeah. Mortal injury.
I can't even see it.
Yeah. It's what they would call a critical wound in Dungeons & Dragons.
With
you know why I can't see it, James? I'm too busy looking at your eyes.
That's it, yeah.
Dreamy eyes.
Good Lord.
What happens on tour stays on tour, Helen. Anyway, let's move on to... Let me see. This one comes from Maggie May 109. This is a listener question, folks. We're getting straight into it this week. Ish. A listener question from Maggie May 109, who slid into my DMs, as I do say every week. I am on a seemingly endless flight across the US, and I was wondering, what do you all watch when you travel? Old classics, newer movies you may have missed in the theater? I've decided to go with Across the Spider-Verse to start. This is Maggie May on Twitter. Thanks. Appreciate all that you do. See, Helen, all that you do. So she appreciates the fact you tried to brain James with a car boot.
Mm-hmm.
It's encouraging to have that validation.
It is, isn't
Yay.
It?
Yay. What do I watch on planes? I tend to go for the mid-range films that I didn't get around to watching when they were in cinemas, you know?
Right, yeah.
Like something with Owen Wilson and a dog
wow.
in it. Yeah, I will probably watch on a plane.
So do you watch stuff that is on the flight? Do you watch the in-flight entertainment
roster? Yes, I watch the in-flight entertainment roster where available. Obviously, if I'm going on a shorter whole thing where there isn't going to be in-flight movies, I will have my iPad or whatever loaded. But for...
With episodes of Supernatural?
Naturally.
With all the nipples?
Again,
the nipple cut.
So little shirtlessness. But
800 minutes of pure wall-to-wall nipples.
Why would that be attractive to you? I don't understand. Anyway, but yeah, I watch mid-level, a bit shit, but not too shit movies.
Okay.
I do occasionally make an exception. I will rewatch a beloved classic. When we flew over to Florida for our trip, mm-hmm. I actually watched Key Largo because I'd never seen it.
Oh,
and
that's
I thought
nice.
That would
that's
be
a nice
on,
film
on
to watch.
Brand, on theme.
Going to Florida. That's a nice one.
Let's watch a crime thriller. But,
let's watch a crime thriller.
But
yeah, with
generally speaking, I don't think that the plane is the place for
the plane.
Big spectacular movies, nor for beloved classics, unless you know them well already.
All righty, Helen. Alex, what do you watch on a plane?
I refuse to watch anything on a plane. My iPad is old and broken. And run out of source space. So that's out of the equation. I will not watch in
flight. All right, Grandpa Simpson. Jesus.
Victim.
Turn it up!
The conditions for watching in flight entertainment on a plane are so terrible, and I'm such a film fascist, I refuse. First of all...
Just a film fascist. We must point that out.
Yeah, just a film fascist. Well, okay. I will... First of all, most of the films are probably adapted in some way.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
There might be swearing taken out. There might be scenes
yes.
cut out, and you will never know. I've done a feature before for another publication on in-flight entertainment. I interviewed lots of people who work for airlines and the companies that make these things. These films get butchered in ways that you're not even aware of. Apart from that, the headphones that give you on planes are fucking terrible.
Oh, well, I don't want to use those.
You don't have any choice.
Sometimes you do.
You do nowadays. You're thinking
not
like 10 years ago.
No, I'm thinking 2 weeks ago.
You're thinking of, because Alex has flown, because let's be honest, post-pandemic, some people will say we're still in a pandemic, but you know, hey, you know, we kind of are. But certainly post-pandemic, the opportunities for long-distance travel have diminished, shall we say. We don't travel as much as we used to.
No, but I've had a couple of long-distance flights for work in the last few months, and their headphones are rubbish. They're so rubbish. You just throw them away afterwards. Okay, but also, the sound... I'm sorry, I know this is very old man Chowser Cloud, but the sound of the plane is so loud, it's louder than the sound of the film. There are some classics that I've never watched, and every time I get on a plane, all right, I'm dying to watch Dog Day Afternoon, I know, but I've never seen it. And I went on a flight a couple of months ago, they had Dog Day Afternoon, I thought, I've got a glass of wine, I'm finally going to watch Dog Day Afternoon. I lasted 5 minutes because I couldn't hear what they were saying.
Okay, but have you considered putting your... noise-canceling headphones over your plane headphones. Even if they don't allow you to plug in your noise-canceling headphones, you can put them on top and it cuts out the noise of the plane engine and then you can hear the movie.
But even then, the screens are tiny, the picture is shit. Like, do I want to watch Dog Day Afternoon on a plane? Like, and listen, I watch a lot of films. To be honest, I can do for a few hours when I'm on a plane to just listen to a podcast, sit down, read something. I read on planes. God, I'm so boring. I'm really sorry, but that's the answer.
It was a good answer. I particularly enjoyed the first part before I nodded off, but it was very, very good. Very good. James, what do you do on a plane?
I never, ever, ever even look at what the offering is on the plane,
same.
And I exclusively bring my own entertainment with me.
Okay, but what do you watch on a plane?
I will always watch TV, naturally, because, you know, I have lots to watch for the Pilot TV podcast. And I will use my noise-canceling headphones, because it's impossible to watch anything without those. Mm-hmm. And I watch them all on my giant iPad.
Wow, size isn't everything, James.
When you said I bring my own entertainment with me, I just thought, he gets out Cluedo.
Yes, yeah, I bring some a stack of cards, play some solitaire.
An inflatable paddling pool.
Generally, I will either watch, you know, I'll binge watch a TV show, or I will sort of, and if it's a long flight, like LA or something, I'll split that between binge watching a TV show and occasionally like playing games on my iPad. So I'll flip between the two things. On the way to Florida, when I last went there, I spent the entire flight playing the kind of interactive movie video game explosion thing, Immortality, which I think I spoke about on here, where you have to zoom in on some of the footage of this old 70s thing to uncover a mystery. Unfortunately, some of the things you have to zoom in on are breasts. And I remember looking back and watching me zoom in on breasts on this thing. And I was just like, I just felt like they were like, what is this guy doing with the touchy porn stuff?
You did say you bring your own entertainment.
Yeah. In that case, it was a little bit dodge. But honestly, I played that game solidly for 10 hours and didn't stop.
Oh, Stuart, this Wi-Fi isn't working. Pornhub isn't loading for me.
It's true.
But last flight I was on, I went to the toilet at one point. That's not the whole story. But
is that related to what James was doing?
Yeah, James was with me.
Put it away.
But you know, I saw a lot of people watching Oppenheimer on the in-flight, and I just wanted to go, stop it. What are you doing? You cannot watch this film like this. That's how I feel.
You're a purist.
Yeah, but
very much so.
Do you not agree?
Already seen it, I don't mind so much.
I know what he's saying though, because like I mean, I'm happy to watch TV shows. Although even though there are some TV shows I don't like to watch on my iPad that will upset me, like Game of Thrones or whatnot. But
that's a more lighting thing, isn't it?
For some of it, but then you can just whack the brightness on. Mm. But for big like cinematic films, it's not the ideal way to experience it.
It's the opposite of the ideal.
Yeah, I'm 100%. Like, can you imagine watching Dune on like? No, just absolutely
not. No, but people will.
They absolutely will. But I cannot sanction that buffoonery.
But again, if it's a rewatch, I don't know. Judge so harshly, like whatever.
I'm judging. I'm judging you right now. Please don't hurt me. Please don't kill me. Yeah. Stay there.
Oh my God, she's got a car boot.
She's coming. No car. She just goes around with a car boot to smash James over there.
I'm ready for a sale at any moment or something.
Absolutely slams it. Well, that's exciting. As for me, because I know you're all on tenterhooks, you're all gagging to hear what I do. I don't watch in-flight entertainment systems either, although I do like to go in sometimes and see what they have. And if there's something that I haven't seen, that is maybe... Sometimes they have stuff that's not in cinemas here yet.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember Richard Linklater's movie... Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Bernadette, Where'd You Go? Yeah. The Cate Blanchett movie? Cate Blanchett. That didn't come out in the cinemas here for a long, long time. And yet it was on an in-flight system for me once, as was Steven Soderbergh's, I think the Steven Soderbergh movie with Meryl Streep that I still think hasn't come out here, and I can't remember the name of it.
I think you're right.
The one on the cruise ship.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, certainly.
Yeah, it probably is out now, but certainly the last few Soderbergh joints have gone straight to streaming, apart from that one. But I won't watch them because they tend to get interrupted by announcements.
Yeah.
And those are really loud in your ears, and I don't like the films being interrupted. I want to interrupt it. If I'm going to interrupt a film, I want to interrupt it myself with my fingers, not in a sex way, and pause it myself. In terms of the things I bring on my iPad, I will bring a selection of stuff. I'll go around all the streaming services I'm connected to, subscribed to, and I'll see what they have that I fancy watching either for the first time or something like I haven't seen before. Most recently, something like Cue the Winged Serpent, which was on Prime Video. I'll watch that, or I'll download something cool on Disney or Netflix that I've seen before, but I want to wallow in again on the flight, like a Crimson Tide. So that's what I'll watch. I'll mix it up.
Crimson Tide this week.
Oh, it's a great film, isn't it?
It is, but I remain a Hunt for a Red October household, really.
Oh, okay.
I feel it's important to choose a side there.
So. I don't think you have to choose a side.
I choose a side.
You can have two big subs, as I frequently do.
Delicious.
Welcome to my underground sub. It's long, hard, and full of semen.
There we ended the debate.
Here ended the lesson. Anyway, should we move on?
Let's.
Should we move on? Because we have a tight show today. We have many, many wonderful hard outs. Helen, where are you going?
I'm going to see a violent film.
Oh, can you say what it is?
I don't know. I don't think I can until the 22nd.
Huh. Even though I think you've told me what this film is, I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Because I wasn't paying attention.
Nope, that's pretty much par for the course.
Violent film.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out on the 22nd.
No, I didn't say that.
Coming out before the 22nd.
Probably not. The embargo.
Coming out after the 22nd.
Yes, I believe so.
There we go. Who's in it?
What's it called?
Give me the first six letters of the name.
No.
Damn it.
I don't have a hard out. I will stay here recording this podcast for
me
hours.
And you, Alex.
Okay,
we're going to go.
Alex.
We're going to go. We're going to go full sub. We're going to go long, and we're going to go hard. That's right.
Finally.
Finally.
In the office.
James, what's your hard out?
My hard out is just before 6 p.m.
Yes, but where are you going?
Where am I going?
Yes.
I'm going to an alumnus meeting from my former university.
Mr. Tumnus.
What
you're meeting
that?
Mr. Tumnus.
Like a school reunion.
It's a bit like that. It's like a gathering for people who went to my university.
All right. So are you looking forward to seeing people that you haven't seen purpose?
These are not, no one I know will be there at all.
Oh, so why are you going?
Because I was invited.
That's very gracious of you.
Yeah.
But you always turn down stuff that people are going.
Yeah, I'm trying something new.
Why are you going to this and not to Helen's Violent Film, which is called? Damn it. I thought I had her.
I'm largely just hiding from Helen. It's really.
What if she's at the same thing?
Well, she won't be because she's going to a violent film and I'm going somewhere where there will be safety in numbers.
There you go. I actually met an alumna from my college at the weekend.
Really?
Emily Mortimer went to my college.
Went to your college?
Yeah.
How did you just randomly meet her?
It was a
nepo baby. Emily Mortimer went to your college.
She did. And she was, I met her on a day off from her new film, which is directed by Noah Baumbach, which she wrote with him.
She wrote the film with Noah Baumbach?
Yeah. And it stars George Clooney and Adam Sandler. Isn't that an interesting
mix? Hang on a second. Is it filming right now?
Yeah.
Is that why the Sandman is here in London? He's
the
constantly...
The Sandman hath cometh.
He was at the Challengers premiere last night.
Oh, my God. The Sandman, he was on a few weeks ago, of course. Adam, if you're listening to this, and I know that you are, Lynn, do please come along. You're welcome anytime.
Absolutely.
I presume you don't have a hard out. So, yeah.
He could take over from us.
He could, because Helen's off to see a violent film, which is Planet of the Apes, The Fall Guy. A violent film. Death Wish 6.
You won't guess it, Chris. I should tell
you. Do you know it?
Yeah. Off mic.
The Joker 2.
Oh, you know me too well. Does that
Joker
bring us
2.
To news?
I think it does. Oh my God. Segway of the Year. British Podcast Awards entry is coming up very, very soon. They don't have a Segway of the Year category. I've checked. And you know why they don't? Because we would fucking walk it. That's why.
All the nominees are... Empire Podcast.
The Empire Podcast. The Empire Podcast. And the Pilot TV Podcast. And the winner is the Pilot TV Podcast. Oh, God! That's my worst nightmare. I wake up in the middle of the night, sheets soaked in sweat. Oh, God, I dreamt that Pilot beat us to an award. And then my wife goes, that was no dream. And then she shows us the podcast publisher's award that you won a couple of years ago because you entered and we didn't. Anyway, okay, so Joker 2 trailer came out. Helen, as the world's leading expert and advocate for the Joker, did you enjoy the mens rea that was on display in this trailer? I fucking loved it.
The whole point is he doesn't have mens rea. You know what?
Oh, it's Batman's rea. Sorry,
oh,
my mistake.
Okay, so you know the way that before the trailer dropped this week, they dropped a trailer for the trailer, which was him standing in the rain, cry laughing. Funny, because that's basically what I've been doing since seeing this.
Did you not think it was good trailer?
No.
Oh, I thought it was very, very good.
Really?
Yeah,
why?
I'm excited for it. It was fucking cool. Those two look great together. I want to see what goes on with those two being...
Those two crazy kids.
Who are those two crazy kids for people who may not have seen
Joaquin
the trailer?
Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga as Harley Quinn going around being loons, singing and having a doomed romance, a bad romance, some might say, together. I like the first film as well, so in your face.
In your poker face.
Yeah.
Take that. I just wanted to take a good look at you.
Take that and party.
All right, let's bring in Switzerland in this. James is neutral at the moment. He is clearly not paying attention. What are you doing?
You don't want to know.
Take that away from him. Whatever it is,
basically,
he's doing.
I did a huge amount of work on a piece that went up yesterday, and I realized just before starting this podcast that none of the work I did in it saved. None of it. So it's just riddled with errors, and it is live on the website. So I'm trying to fix them.
Oh, I see.
So I'm quite cross that this thing happened.
And what's your excuse for all the other articles you've written?
Yeah.
All right. So where do you stand on the Joker?
The actual original Joker, I don't have a lot of fondness for. Not because it wasn't well made or wasn't well acted, but I find Joaquin Phoenix quite hard to like in most of his roles.
I love him in most of his roles.
I struggle to connect with him in this, obviously more than anything else, by design. And it is a grubby little film, again, by design. So it's got big incel energy and I've never really wanted to revisit it.
Has it though?
I don't know. I suspect it will at least have some. But maybe it will have a slightly different feel to it and I'll like it a lot more.
This is Todd Phillips' sequel, which we haven't even said the name of. Well done, news team.
I think you said it at the beginning.
I said Joker sequel. That's pretty much it.
That's what it's called.
This is Todd Phillips' Joker Folie à Deux, which of course in French means...
At two.
Is that what it means?
Madness at two.
There we go. Madness at two.
I think it's a delusional condition, isn't it?
It's a shared madness. It's a shared cake of three, basically.
Yeah. So this is, case it wasn't clear, this is, because I don't think it was, this is the sequel to Joker, which came out a few years ago and won Oscars and made over $1 billion, and everyone loved it without exception, which was great. We were all very, very excited about this. This trailer I thought was really good.
Mm-hmm.
This is a musical that is, once again, hiding its musicality. So you get to see clips from song and dance numbers, but you don't actually hear the songs that they're going to be singing. I don't know. What's Joaquin Phoenix's voice like? Alex, do you know?
A singing voice?
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, did he sing in Walk the Line? I think he did, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think he did. I mean, I'm sure he's got a very nice voice. But I'd tell you what, the trailer doesn't give much away. It's more of a teaser, really. But I will say, it looks like it's doing its own thing. It doesn't look like it's just treading over the same ground. And whereas the first one was so obviously taking from King of Comedy and Taxi Driver, this doesn't look like that. And I think it's doing something different. I'm intrigued by it.
Yeah. So this obviously stars Joaquin Phoenix. He's back as Arthur Fleck. You get Lady Gaga, who has now been confirmed as Harley Quinn. Some people are saying that she seems to be an inmate in this psychiatric facility.
Yes,
but
Arkham Asylum.
Is it Arkham Asylum? Definitely, because I know there's an Arkham thing later on, but I wonder if they were maybe
I think that's a fantasy sequence, I suspect.
Is it not?
I think they're in Arkham Asylum, so they fantasize about being on the roof of Arkham Hotel.
I mean, much of the title lends itself to maybe a lot of the film is a delusion. I don't know.
It does look beautiful, I have to say that.
It looks
really, really striking. Yep, returning from the first movie. And finishes with this great shot of Harley Quinn drawing a smiley face with lipstick on the glass of the prison thing that they're in. There you go. That's a technical term. And then, of course, he slides into position and it makes it look like a Joker smile.
Yeah. It's a good shot.
It's a good shot. Very, very good shot. So, all right. Fingers crossed. We're all on tenterhooks. Every day is Christmas Eve.
Every single day.
Every day is Christmas Eve. So, Joker, Folie à Deux, coming October.
Mm.
October. Very exciting. Can Joaquin Phoenix do something that I don't think has ever been done? Helen, is this right? And win an Oscar, win an Oscar for the same performance.
Has that ever been done? I'm going to have to think about it, but I don't believe it has.
I would say the odds are stacked against him.
Mm.
But anyway, we shall see. We shall see. All right, Jimbo.
Hello.
I will interrupt your typing reverie.
Must you?
I must, yes.
This thing has upset me a lot.
Yes, I can see. Do you have any... Let's get you away from that for a second and talk about movie news. Do you have anything that you want to talk about?
Do I have anything I want to talk about news-wise? I watched the trailer for it's Speak No Evil, which is the James McAvoy horror type affair, which on the one hand has a fairly generic setup, isn't it? People on holiday meet other people on holiday, become friends, meet up, and then the friends turn out to be raging psychopaths.
Mm.
But it's actually a lot creepier than the setup would indicate. And actually, it freaked me out quite a lot. James McAvoy, of course, who was genuinely terrifying in Split, less so in Glass, but really good in that. And he has that same sense of... you know, sort of spin on a dime psychopathy and physical intimidation in this. Like, he's wearing a kind of singlet in it. He's quite ripped. I don't know. Like, this looks a bit scary.
Well, you had me at quite ripped.
Yeah.
But this is a remake, isn't it, of a Danish film. And the original is super duper horrible. Like, this is a disturbing ass film. This will make you never go on holiday. And if you do, never talk to anyone on holiday.
I mean, yeah, that's genuinely how I operate.
You already
anyway,
do,
so,
James, yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm intrigued to see if they go as hard as the original film.
Yeah, the
original's
nasty.
Really
it's
nasty.
I haven't seen the original, but I'm not watching this trailer because I've seen a few people on Twitter already saying, do not watch this trailer. It gives away everything.
I mean, it does feel like it spells out most of the beats. I mean, I don't know what else happens, but it's from the trailer. There is a complete narrative in the trailer. I'm sure there's more to it than that, but yeah, you can certainly believe that that's our film.
It gives away a lot. Yeah. This is a Blumhouse film, and it is written and directed by James Watkins, who is no stranger to horror. He directed the likes of The Woman in Black remake with...
Scary movie.
Remake? Can you remake something that technically was a TV show? TV movie? But yeah, that was good. And Eden Lake, which bears a superficial resemblance to this movie, I would say, as well. So, yeah, he knows his way around scary shit.
And speaking of Blumhouse, they are doing another Blair Witch, for better or worse, I'm saying.
I wish they wouldn't. I like Blumhouse, but I want people to stop trying to remake Blair Witch. It's killing me. That film, I love Blair Witch. It's one of my favourite films, let alone horror films.
Go stand in the corner.
Yeah, very good. But it was lightning in a bottle. Sorry, I've completely hijacked what you were saying.
No, do it. Go for it.
I love that film, but it was lightning in a bottle. The way they made it, the way it turned out was just extraordinary, I think. They did a shit sequel to it. They did a shit reboot to it. It wasn't shit, but it wasn't very good. And now they're doing it again. It's like, it's not a franchise. It's not mythology. It was one brilliant film with a very definitive start and end, and I want them to leave it alone.
Now, Alex, the
original—it's
still there. It's intact. It's like your bus fare home. That money's safe. It's in the bank.
Yeah, but why? What are they going to do with it? What's to expand on?
If anyone's playing the drinking game at home, this is now James's time to say it's the pissing in the pool thing, isn't it?
It is. It is very much the pissing in the pool thing.
There we go.
Stop pissing in pools.
Especially if witches are involved.
I remember the original filmmakers, whose names I've forgotten, who made the first one, which was so brilliant.
Wasn't it Eduardo Sanchez and
Daniel Myrick? Was it? Yeah.
Very good.
So I don't think
you just read that, didn't you? Yeah. Fuck's sake.
I do remember they were saying if they ever wanted to do a sequel, I think they were involved in the second one and to some extent. Was it Adam Wingard who did the
Adam Wingard, yeah.
The film was all right, but pointless.
No Godzilla, though, so disappointing.
No, I think they said they had an idea that their idea for a follow-up would be a prequel set in the medieval ages, getting into the origins of that witch and witch. It's like, okay, that's interesting. Sort of, let's get into Robert Eggers territory maybe. But that never happened, and now it's just Blair Witch, Blair Witch, Blair Witch. I don't know. I just think, stop.
I've seen some people on Twitter say that the part of the impact of the first movie was that brief period of about, what, a week, maybe less than a week, when people thought it was a real found footage film that something bad had happened to these people and that a studio had taken this found footage.
It was the 90s. We were all very naive.
And distributed it in cinemas rather than using it as evidence.
But it was that good. The whole marketing revolved around that. And remember when the DVD came out, there was a 45-minute documentary on it, which was like, this is a documentary about the reality behind this film. It
crucially,
was so convincing.
It was one of the first films to have like a big involved mythology website came up around it.
Yeah.
The Blair Witch website was wild.
Yeah,
loved
and it all had all the stuff about Coffin Rock and the witch and it like it built this big, big, deep mythology, which meant when you saw the film, you kind of felt like it was real.
Well, I don't know. We shall see. First one, was it lightning in a bottle? I mean, they said the same about Paranormal Activity, and then the best one was Paranormal Activity 5.
Was that the best one?
No.
Yeah, but
I genuinely thought you were like, oh, was it? Was it five? Five was the best? I stopped watching after
very
two.
Very much diminishing returns.
Okay, fine.
Still. Don't you think Blair Witch was great and they've never done anything good with it again?
No, they haven't, yeah. Apparently, though, one of the guys, I think it was Sanchez, directed a Bigfoot found footage movie, which is, I think, maybe even called Bigfoot. I'm not quite sure.
Right.
I have never seen it.
No.
But someone was raving about it on Twitter recently, and apparently it's decent. So
I follow a character called Sack Squash on Instagram, who is a Bigfoot who plays saxophone. Just so you'd want to know that he
Bigfoot,
exists.
Bigfoot, big instrument.
Guess
you know what they say about the size of a man's saxophone?
Okay. Hey, speaking of horror movies.
Oh, right. Okay.
Were you aware that Nia DaCosta is in talks to do the second of the 28 Years Later trilogy? Because everything is a trilogy.
Is this 28 millennia later? Which one is this?
No, this is... They're not just going to do one 28 years later. They're going to do like three 28 years laters.
So that's...
28 centuries later, 28 millennia later.
No,
yes.
They're just going to do years.
That's 84 years later. I'm confused.
I guess.
All right, okay.
Yeah. But apparently Alex Garland's going to write the whole trilogy, and then there's going to be different directors for each film. So Danny Boyle will do the first one.
Oh, I'd love it if it directed the first film in a trilogy.
And then it would be Nia DaCosta for the second.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. Yes. I hope she isn't too burned by the Marvels, because that must have sucked for her, and she's awesome, and she doesn't deserve it. I hope that she's got her Hedda Gabler. Wasn't it a Hedda Gabler film she was doing?
She's got her Hedda Gabler attached. Tessa Thompson. Yeah, they filmed that.
I think they have. So hopefully that goes brilliantly as well, and then she can, you know, go into this and scare us as much as she did on Candyman.
Candyman. Don't say
very
it.
Very scary.
Do not say it. So this is the 28... Is that what they're calling it, 28 years later?
I believe so.
Trilogy. That's interesting. Are they all then meant to be running, flowing into each other? It's a cool idea. It's a cool idea. It like reminds me of the Danny Boyle, the ill-fated alien love triangle. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That never actually happened. It was announced. He may have filmed part of it. It was meant to be an anthology film with three different filmmakers, and it never quite came together ultimately. But yeah, this one's worrying me because apparently Cillian Murphy might be coming back for the first one.
Why does that worry you?
Because they're going to kill him.
Why does that worry?
Because I like that character and I don't want to see him die. I've got this attachment to characters in horror films, and if they come back for a sequel, I like to see them get passed through the sequel as well. Mm. I don't like films that bring characters back for a horror sequel just to kill them. Like, it's a big bugbear.
Maybe they won't
kill him. Han Solo.
Like Han Solo, who came back for the most terrifying film of them all, Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Still shudder about that film. Although the next one was pretty good, and then they stopped.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So they're also making a Five Nights at Freddy's sequel.
We're continuing the next scary developments.
Yeah.
Although the most horrifying thing was, in fact, Sebastian Stan as Trump. That's the thing that scared me the most this week.
Well, speaking of Cannes, because that's going to be in Cannes, which kicks off very, very soon. And a lot of stuff is already has been announced in competition. One thing that's really interesting is Francis Ford Coppola's Deadline, give him some respect. Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which is going to be in competition. Now, there's been a big hullabaloo this week because apparently Megalopolis, which obviously Coppola paid for himself, this is the film he's been wanting to make for decades now.
Yeah.
And then no studio would go near it or give him the money. So he sold part of his wine empire to fund this and has self-funded this movie. And then it's been screening for people in Hollywood. And the word coming out of the screenings has not been great, sadly.
Yeah, it's been sort of, it's interesting, and we're glad that he exists, and he wants $100 million sort of marketing campaign for it, and we don't think the film can support that. It's not necessarily a full condemnation of it. They're not necessarily saying it's bad. They're just saying it's not a major blockbuster, I think. So, you know, that gives me some hope that it'll at least be like an interesting
Did any of us expect
movie.
It to be a mainstream
Well, no. Apparently Francis Ford Coppola did, if he's asking for $100 million of advertising. $100 million
or maybe
plus,
he
according
just
to
thinks
that story.
It's a good enough, big enough film that it deserves that, regardless of the fact that it's not a tentpole movie. I don't know.
I mean, of all Sadly, people, I feel like he's realistic enough.
I've seen people on Twitter this week going, how can you not market this movie? This is from Francis Ford Coppola, the guy behind The Godfather and The Godfather 2 and The Godfather 3 and, you know, and some of the greatest films of all time. And it's got an all-star cast. And why don't you just put those names in the poster? It sells itself. It doesn't. Because the biggest name in the movie is Adam Driver, and we love Adam Driver. He's amazing. But that guy does not put bums in seats. And Francis Ford Coppola's name these days does not put bums in seats. And Forrest Whitaker's name, with the best one in the world, does not put bums in seats. And that's your problem.
Yeah.
That's your problem. So therefore, your movie, I hope it's brazen. Listen, I really do. Yeah. I hope it's incredible. I hope it's a return to form and that the genius behind Apocalypse Now reveals himself once again. But if he hasn't revealed himself, then you need a little bit more to get studios interested to make that level of investment, sadly.
It does sadden me slightly that this whole story is being talked about in context of how mainstream is it, how successful it's going to be, how much money it's going to be cost in box office, where you just want to see a fucking good Francis Ford Coppola film.
But I think that's the subtext, isn't it? Clearly, yeah. If it was something that blew people away, they'd be going for it.
Yeah.
But the fact that some of the more independent-oriented studios are even saying maybe not, that maybe speaks volumes. But it's in competition at Cannes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it's amazing. They've accepted it in competition. Maybe it'll do well. Maybe it'll win something. And then the ball gets rolling.
Very interesting. Yeah. I mean, everything's just scuttlebutt at the moment. This is all secondary sources from people, you know.
As somebody pointed out, you know, you could do worse than that Hollywood Reporter story as the start of your big push.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
For the film.
Also Cannes-related, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola's old pal, is going to receive an honorary Palme d'Or.
Yeah, they saw our Empire special prequel celebration issue and went, fuck, you know, we're missing a trick here.
When is a Palme d'Or not a Palme d'Or? When it's a Jar Jar.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
Oh, boy.
My
that
God.
Was, you know That's what? That was good. You know what? I'm going to give you that one. That was good. That was...
Helen is not going to slam a car boot on my head.
Not today.
There
she
we go.
Might.
That's exciting, though.
I can see Jar Jar being hit by a car boot.
Oh, look at that. That's a world. That's what he would say. Oh, Petal, be car. That's what he would say. This is good news. George. They might tempt George. I hope he wears a plaid tuxedo. That would be amazing. I hope he turns up in a big old plaid shirt.
George is, I mean, is he the world's most successful independent filmmaker? Can we say that?
I think so.
Eduardo Sanchez and Daniel Myrick might beg to differ, but yes.
Yeah, their franchise is going on as well. I don't know if they've made quite as much money as
No, I don't think they have.
Good for George.
Good for George.
Good for George.
Well, good for George. And the last thing is, good
Bridget
for Bridget Jones.
Yes.
Jinx.
I'm concerned, but I'm intrigued and interested. So this is...
I'm intrigued, but also aroused.
Really?
Yes.
We have very
the big
different...
pants. It's the big pants.
It's the big pants. Okay, so yes, a fourth Bridget Jones is apparently on its way. Renée Zellweger is obviously returning in the title role. Bridget now has a child, which, spoiler, happened at the end of the last one.
Oh, now, that's right, it did.
Here's what's interesting. So Michael Morris is directing, blah, blah, blah. What's interesting
Oh, Michael Morris.
Yes.
Genuinely, I didn't know that. That's really good.
Oh, he's is that good?
He directed a lot of Better Call Saul.
Oh, fantastic.
Very good director.
Excellent director. So the good news is that Hugh Grant is back as Daniel Cleaver, Rogue. Emma Thompson is back.
Yes.
She was a gynecologist.
So?
She's maybe made friends with Bridget since delivering her child, and now they just hang.
Maybe she's seen an opening in Bridget's life.
Oh, God.
What? No. Leah Woodall from One Day is in it. What's interesting is who's not in it. Absent currently is Colin Firth. And we're also told that Bridget has to look for love all over again following a tragic death.
Yeah.
Not Mark. Do you think they buried him in the reindeer jumper?
He's Mark in Dead Sea.
Look, he came back to life in whatever.
Kingsman.
Yeah. Kingsman. Yes, maybe he'll come back to life.
Please do the same thing.
You never know.
That would be hilarious.
Manners maketh man.
Chiwetel Ejiofor is also in it, so I wonder if that's the new love interest.
She might find love.
But Hugh Grant's also in it. Also
well, she's not going to find love with
like
him.
He's like a thorough rotter.
He's a cad,
yeah,
Alex.
But
he's a bounder.
She fancies him.
He's a scoundrel.
I know, and she can shag him if she wants, but she shouldn't, you know, shack up with him, should
she? No, but
she?
He might have changed.
He's an
Oompa
Loompa these days.
Sure.
Do you not believe in a redemption, Helen?
I actually don't want redemption for Daniel Cleaver, no.
Oh.
There you go.
We didn't even talk about the fact that Steve Coogan's in the Joker sequel. What the hell?
Well,
I mean,
is he fulfilling the Marc Maron role from the first one?
Did we know that?
I think I'd seen that written down somewhere.
All right. Because it was a big shock to me when he turned up.
It does give you a bit of a jolt.
Yeah. Sadly, not as Alan Gordon Partridge, the only person I think who could go toe-to-toe with Arthur Fleck.
Maybe Alan Gordon Partridge is the delusion.
Maybe he is.
Maybe he's the true duh in the folie duh.
I want to see Alan Partridge now trying to buy tickets for Joker folie a deux.
Yeah.
Pronounce that. Exciting stuff. Well done, everybody involved. And well done, everybody involved in the new issue of Empire. My God.
Segway.
And the nominees are the Empire Podcast for Segway of the Year. Boom, 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 boom. For the bit where Chris did a song.
Amazing.
That was amazing. That was very good. So yes, the new issue of Empire is on sale right now. It's new Empire Day, even as we speak, as I record this on Thursday, the 11th of April in the year of our Lord, 2024?
Sure.
Yeah, sure, why not? And what is on the cover, folks?
It's The Acolyte. Star Wars, The Acolyte. It's the new Star Wars show by showrunner Leslie Headland, and it's set around the period of the High Republic, right? And it's just basically...
Whoa, dude.
It's a shitload of Jedi. It's a time...
Is that the collective term?
A shitload of Jedi. A Sith load of Jedi, surely.
I think it's actually a fuckload of Jedi. And it's set... is it 100 years before The Phantom Menace? I don't know. It's before The Phantom Menace, when everything was lovely in the galaxy and there was no evil around and there were lots of Jedi keeping the peace, except... some shit does go down. There are dark forces and there's a Wookiee Jedi in it, and there's Amanda Stenberg and Carrie Ann Moss.
Double souled.
With a lightsaber. Daphne Keane with a lightsaber.
Triple souled.
And our own Ben Travis spoke to...
quadruple souled.
Absolutely everybody involved.
I see.
And did this fantastic cover story. Are we excited about that show? I hope we are, right?
Yeah.
It does look very cool. It looks like a bit of Star Wars that we haven't seen before.
Yeah. Right? What else is in the issue?
We have a feature on Luca Guadagnino's Challenges, which is an incredible... am I the only person in this room who's seen it?
Yes.
Yes, well, you didn't share your invitation. So, I mean, really, that's on you.
I've seen it a couple of times, and I think it's extraordinary. Zendaya is Josh O'Connor. It's Mike Feist. It's brilliant. And Ollie Richard spoke to all of those people and the writer. It's fantastic. There are also features on Doctor Who. Boyd Hilton spoke to Russell T. Davis and Shuti Gatwa together to talk about what they are doing with this new era of the show. And that is a fantastic, fun, and very warm-hearted, sprawling interview. We have Beth Webb talking to director Richard Linklater and star Glenn Powell about their film Hitman.
Love it.
Isn't it great?
It's so good.
So fun.
I am so much looking forward to that film.
You're going to love it.
Yeah. You will love it.
Is it in my wheelhouse?
Very much so.
Excellent.
It's all four of your wheels. We have an...
not the car boot.
No, thank you. We have an in-depth conversation with Daisy Ridley. John Nugent pitched me a feature on human traffic. He said, why don't we do something about the making of human traffic? I thought... okay.
Did you reply? All right, brother!
I said, if you can get Danny Dyer, then nice one, brother. He did. We got the director, we got Danny Dyer, we got John Sim, and it's fucking hilarious. And then we have a feature on Zack Snyder. Chris, you can talk about that one, because you did it.
I spoke to Zack Snyder. All right, the new issue of Empire. This is a kind of, if you remember, public access from a few years ago, where readers used to send in questions, and we've kind of brought that back for this. Mm. So this is reader questions to Zack Snyder.
It's a really fun piece, actually. I have read that one. I haven't read all of them yet, but
yes, he's very... I like Zack Snyder a lot. He's very personable. He's a lovely, lovely guy. I know that some people have made their minds up about his movies, but maybe this will change your mind. Maybe this will change your mind. He's also a very self-aware guy. This is a thing I think people don't think that he is aware of his reputation or how people perceive his films politically. But he very much does. Mm. And that's all addressed in this piece. So there we go.
In the front section, we have stories on Michael Douglas, a fantastic interview with him about his new Franklin show. We have a piece on Inside Number 9, the final series is coming on soon. We have Maya Hawke on playing anxiety in Inside Out 2, which I'm very much looking forward to. And then Chris, your section, Eddie Marsan.
Yeah, I've literally no idea what's in my section, so this is very good. Eddie Marsan's in it, brilliant. That's good. And there's something in the...
Spaceman spoiler special.
Yeah, Spaceman spoiler special. And the opening is... who is it?
Ava Green.
It's Ava Green. I did that interview.
I did that interview, yes.
Ava Green for a couple of films, actually, for Three Musketeers,
Milady,
and The Dreamers. And she was so much fun. So it was so great to talk to. So that's it. Oh, what a belter of an issue.
It is. It's actually very, very good.
What a cracker of an issue. Oh my God, if I wasn't doing the show, I'd rush out right now and go around there and grab a copy for free. But you guys should get a copy for not free. It is available right now in all good, evil, and virtual news agents. Go out, run out, buy a copy, pay our wages, you lovely people. There you go. I'm learning.
You're getting so much better, Chris.
Like the raptors testing the fences. All right, time now for this week's guest. We only have one guest this week. I haven't overbooked, unless I've forgotten someone, in which case it'll be someone at the end of this podcast, which I will dub in a panic. But anyway, Back to Black, which is Sam Taylor Johnson's biopic of Amy Winehouse, is out in cinemas this week. And you might think, well, that's a bit of a tricky, tall order for any actor who wants to fill Amy Winehouse's shoes and towering beehive and astonishing voice. And it is. But Marisa Abella, who is a relatively speaking a newcomer, you may have seen her in the odd thing here or there, fills those shoes and that beehive and even that voice, which for the most part in the movie is her singing. Very, very nimbly indeed. She's really, really good in this. I caught up with her in the London hotel room a couple of weeks ago, and we had a good old blast, a good old natter about a great many things, including, of course, as you might imagine, Amy Winehouse. Here we go. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the star of Back to Black, Marisa Abella. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. How's your junket experience been so far?
It's my first junket. So I actually turned around to Sam yesterday and I was like, are they all like this? And she said, yes, they are.
The answer indeed. Is yes, they are.
And then she's like, oh my God, I forgot you've not. I mean, I did it for a show that I did industry, but it was during COVID. So that was all over Zoom. So this is very different.
Oh God. Yeah. In person is so much better. What's the one question you don't want me to ask that you've been asked a million times already?
Oh my gosh. Well, I feel like you probably have to ask it, but it's like, how did he feel about taking on the role?
I mean,
of course, it's the question that everyone wants to ask, right? And I understand why. It's a big one, but it's, you know, it's like, it's just, it's also, it's a complicated, there are lots of feelings, so it's a complicated one to explain. So to try and sort of narrow it down is actually just difficult. And then you end up saying things and wondering if it's, you know, if it's true.
Well, let me come at it maybe a slightly different way. Can you remember the moment you were told you got the job?
Yes, I do. I was in Edinburgh Airport. I've been at the comedy festival. It was August.
Wow, okay.
And I was on my way to Ibiza. And it was really fun. I was with my boyfriend, and it was really, when I got the phone call, there were 5 minutes, you know, where I was like, oh my God. I mean, I've been auditioning for a while, so I knew it was going to kind of go one way or the other by that point. And then, you know, then you have to get on a plane, find your passport and whatever. And then by the time I'd sat down on the plane and sort of buckled in, I was like, oh my God. And then I wouldn't actually recommend like 3 hours on a flight without any Wi-Fi after you've just been told you have to play Amy White.
Oh,
do you know
shit.
What I mean? So it was that, like, it was a lot of sort of thinking.
Did you want to make an announcement over the tannoy?
I mean, well, also it was Edinburgh to Ibiza, so there were a lot of stag dudes. and it was kind of intense, but no, I remember it clearly. And, you know, as I said, that was August, and then we started filming in January. So I knew that I had time. I had about four full months that I knew I was going to be sort of working every day to prepare.
Sorry, I'm fascinated by this whole Edinburgh Ibiza thing. I may talk for 20 minutes about this.
Yeah.
So you're on this flight for 3 hours and everything's flowing through your head at that point.
God. Yeah.
And I've got the job. Oh my God, it's the best job. Did you tell anyone? Your boyfriend was there, but were you on your phone to your...
Sam Taylor Johnson rung me. So I rung my agent. She was like, I know. But, you know, I think Sam wanted to break the news. That was very exciting. And then I rung my mum, and then I rung my dad, and then I rung my brother. And I think I sort of left it at that. And, you know, it was like, it's incredibly exciting, but the range of emotions between like excitement and fear and responsibility and nerves and like also just sort of what, you know, where do I start, I think was the biggest part of it. And you're just sort of left with your thoughts for all that time. And I think as soon as I landed, I'd sent my email the list that I've been compiling on the plane of like what lessons I want to take, where I want, you know, what I want to do, where I want to live, like all of those things.
Because that's fascinating, because you moved to Camden.
Yeah.
For the Amy boot camp.
Right.
So to speak.
Yeah. I mean, there was no like one, I guess that's kind of what I prepared in, I guess, in a sense. I moved to Camden, honestly. I had flatmates when I booked the job, and I started trying to just do it from home. But it's weird, like, you know, you walk in from a full day of singing or guitar lessons or going to a museum or something, and then you walk in, your friends are sat on the couch watching like some show and cooking dinner, and it just didn't feel like it made any sense. So I think I knew I had to move and have a sort of workspace, and then it just made obvious sense to move to Camden, and it really helped. You know, it really helped in that Camden is its own entity. You know, it's a very specific place with a very specific vibe, and to really feel that, I think you have to live there for a sustained period of time rather than just, you know, visiting like the market or whatever. It's not, that's not what like true Camden is. Yeah. So living there was incredibly useful, and it was also very useful that it was like, weirdly, it was useful that it was on the Northern Line, because all of my classes, I had to go to the gym every morning to train physically, and then and that was in Goodge Street, and then Goodge Street I'd go to Finchley because that's where my singing lessons were, and then I'd go from Finchley to Highgate because that's where my movement lessons were, and then back to Camden. So it was just quite handy, actually.
That's amazing. Imagine if they give you loyalty points for moving up and down the Northern Line,
really
like
cool,
air
actually.
Miles,
yeah,
but on the
totally.
Tube. One quick question. Who did you see in Edinburgh? Which comedians stood out for you?
Wow. I saw Ed Gamble, I think, which was amazing. Fun. And also, I mean, Edinburgh is a very special place for me. My parents met in Edinburgh. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, my brother is a stand-up. So I saw Jack Abella, which was amazing. And, you know, I love to go to Edinburgh every year if I can. I think it's such a cool place to be. And
it's an amazing place.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. All right, there we go. So one thing I noticed in the movie, I mean, is you do have a vocal coach, and you do perform all the songs.
I do, yeah.
In the movie. I just spoke to Sam, and she said that wasn't necessarily the plan when you signed on.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk me through that process and of working with that vocal coach, first of all, and what your hopes and expectations were walking in for the first time? Because I'm guessing you didn't sound like Amy at the audition?
Definitely not. Okay. No, I mean, you know, I think, you know, luckily we have a sort of similar register of voice. She has quite a low voice, and although she has the capacity to sing sort of incredibly high, a lot of her songs sort of start and linger in that register, especially in Frank, because they're quite conversational. So they sort of are from that sort of more talking place. So that kind of made sense to me. I sang in my first audition, but I sang Fly Me to the Moon, and it wasn't in the script. Well, it was in the script, but it sort of said end before you get to that part. And I'd sang it quite a lot at home leading up to the audition. And the good thing about singing something like Fly Me to the Moon is that this is her reference point. And we actually don't, you know, it's not like singing Back to Black or Rehab. We don't know exactly how Amy would have sung that song. So you can take a bit of license with it. And I think the reason that I wanted to sing in that audition and through the film was that, like, you know, this was Amy's chosen mode of expression. This is how she wanted to be heard by the world, both through her sort of songwriting and how she communicated in her songs. I think you ask anyone that went to see an Amy Winehouse concert, it was like, she never sung the song the same way twice. Everything was full of feeling, whether that feeling was like, through the music, or that, you know, the feeling was boredom or whatever the feeling was, it mattered that the sound was coming from the person that was talking, you know, that was portraying Amy. So that was my intention as an actor, was that I didn't do all of this work and then go to open my mouth to sing and we cut to a studio recording.
Yeah.
I really wanted to continue to convey, you know, her wants and needs through this music that she wrote. I was sort of at ease with the fact that I knew it wasn't necessary for me to sing.
Yeah.
Sam had the music, and if we needed to mix or use Amy fully, then we could do. But so I was able to sort of come at it from a place of curiosity and like intrigue and as an actor rather than as a singer. And I think that was incredibly helpful, because then I was able to sort of feel my way through it. And, you know, I worked hard. I worked really hard in those singing lessons. And I think sort of, you know, a month and a half in, Anne-Marie Speed, who was my vocal coach, rung Sam Taylor Johnson and Giles and Martin and said, you should probably come and listen to this now. And they did. And then they said, you know, I got a phone call later on that night from Giles being like, we're going to use you. So
what was the song that convinced him?
I think it was What Is It About Men, actually. Okay. Because I was sat on the floor of the studio playing guitar I was learning to play guitar as well. I was playing guitar and we were doing it as if Amy was writing the song as it is in the film.
Yeah.
And Sam sort of sat down with me and just sort of got her phone out to record. And she recorded the whole thing from start to finish in one take. And that's what sort of ended up in the film, you know, not that footage, but she wanted to sort of be able to stay on me in one take writing this song. And I think she felt that, you know, if we could get that, if we could make audiences feel that excitement of what it is to stick with Amy when we're like, we know what the words are, she doesn't yet, and she's finding it, that would be really exciting. But in order to do that, we needed to use my voice, you know, because that footage isn't out there.
Of course, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think it was that she sort of, we all understood for the first time that the most authentic way, weirdly, to tell this story would be to use my voice.
I guess there's an interesting back and forth in a way between, you switch between recreations of famous Amy performances, Live Lounge, Glastonbury, things like that, the Grammys. And then more intimate moments that I don't think were captured except maybe on someone's camera phone.
Right.
Were those sufficiently different for you? Did you find?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're more imaginative. So that kind of comes with, they both come with their own complexities. You know, one is a feeling of like needing to get it right in a different way because it exists, the footage exists. So I did really want to do as much as I could to sort of get it accurate. You know, something like the Jonathan Ross interview, for example, in sort of 2004, it's such an iconic interview to me, in my mind. So I wanted to really convey what that was, you know, a girl who was equally like nervous, excited, but also determined to get the point across that she is a jazz singer and that she wants to be taken incredibly seriously. So all of these things, as well as the mannerisms, but, you know, I think that the more imaginative scenes, like we're at home with her and her grandma or with Blake, they come with a different, you know, a different challenge because it you take what you know from what you see and what you hear and what you read about her, and then you take a leap of faith, which is, who is Amy Winehouse the lover? You can look at her music to draw inspiration from this sort of like, you know, well of feeling. You can imagine that she was a very sort of passionate person to be around. Mm. But it does take a certain amount of just sort of a, you know, it's a leap. But I found that sort of incredibly creatively fulfilling, especially when I felt like, you know, we got it, we nailed it. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and Amy in the film and in real life as well, I presume, is depicted as this incredibly unpredictable, combustible, capricious person who is warm and loving moment and then a bit wild and rambunctious and rebellious and uncontrollable the next. And I'm fascinated by how you charted that journey.
Well, I mean, honestly, it came through my research in that, like, you know, I'd see her and one interview, I guess, in a sort of situation that's similar to this, and you know, you can tell when someone's wearing the same clothes or when someone's, you know, when they're in the same room or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, one person would ask her something and it would be very much based around the music, and you could feel that, like, you know, they were talking from a place of knowledge and understanding of, let's say, jazz or hip hop or whatever the reference is that she was drawing on at the time. And she would be engaged, incredibly engaged and kind and friendly and smiley and warm towards that person. And you could see what, you know, how when she was excited by something and she felt respected by someone, she would engage with them. And then you'd have an interview that could potentially have been 20 minutes later with someone that was talking to her about like her hair or, you know, something that she, and how bored she looks, you know, or when they compare her to like, you know, Dido or something that she doesn't want to be compared to. The faces, I mean, there was no semblance of her hiding how she felt. So yeah. For me as an actor playing her, I was lucky enough to be able to really chart what those emotions feel like to her. So like, when Amy is bored, she does X. I mean, you can see it. It's not, it's real. And I mean, the only change is through time. You know, she might respond differently in Frank, what I would sort of say is like Frank era Amy to a Back to Black era. She, you know, if she has slightly less energy, it's going to be different. But, you know, there's an amazing interview with her for a show about hip hop, but I think it's in America and she's in a barber shop and she's like so expressive with her movements. Her arms are like moving like crazy and she's so excited by the chance of being there because it's all about the music. And then there are interviews, you know, with MTV where someone compares her to someone that she doesn't want to be compared to and she just stops speaking. You know, like, you're not getting anything out of me. And so in our scenes, Matt writes them really well and charts that journey really well. It was just too easy to me to be like, and sometimes it was a conversation of like, if they asked her this question, she would not respond in that way.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, and that was nice. It was nice to have done that level of research to be able to know.
One thing I like to ask actors a lot on this podcast is first day and last day. So, and the contrast between those two things and how you felt as a performer on the last day as opposed to the first day. What was your first day?
My first day was in Ronnie Scott's.
Wow.
Yeah. So not a small one. My first day was in Ronnie Scott's. I was incredibly nervous, to be completely honest with you. I think I went a little bit, I'd done all of this prep and then I knew that I just sort of needed to let it all go and just respond to the space in that day, but it was hard. And I had Eddie next to me and it was him that was like, you've done all the work now. Just relax. And it was tricky. I was very nervous, but I sort of quickly found my feet in it and the crew were very helpful. And then the last day was actually in New York. We filmed our last day in New York. And I was just kind of like walking the streets of New York because it's that montage in Back to Black.
Yeah.
So I was just sort of, they blocked out a certain block of Fifth Avenue right by the sort of Cartier mansion. And I think we had like 5 minutes before the cars were all going to come again. And I just had to walk across that, whatever, like the zebra crossing type thing there and look up. I mean, like, you know, so it was just kind of felt huge. But it was just, you know, it was sad to say goodbye.
Of course. What an amazing place to rap and then get the whole, that's a rap, Marisa Abella.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Get out of the way. There's a taxi
coming.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd give you a rap gift, but there's a cap over there.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Did you get a rap gift? What?
I did. I got a guitar.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Which is going on eBay or?
No, it's in my living room.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
There you go. Do you play it or is it very much going to be on the wall framed?
The only thing I can play is Amy Winehouse songs. So I haven't really gone back to it.
So you haven't kept it up since?
No. I mean, it feels so linked to this film for me that it's one of those things that's kind of weird to pick up again, I think. But I definitely would love to again. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Marisa Abella. And we'll be discussing Back to Black in just a few minutes because it is now time for the reviews section of the show. But we're going to start off with Mr. 28 Years Later writer man himself, Alex Garland. He's back as director. That's usually the reason to stand up or sit up, whatever you want to do, and pay attention. Civil War is the movie, a remake of Captain America Civil War, I believe. This is an A24 film. And Helen.
Yes, hi.
Talk us through.
So this is set in a terrifyingly near future US where the country has descended into civil war. And it's not just confined to superheroes this time, guys. It's getting really serious. So Nick Offerman plays a president who has declared himself president for a third term. And in response to this, California and Texas have essentially seceded and set up a rival force and gone to war. And so the whole country has been kind of riven. But the Western forces of Texas and California are now sort of rounding on Washington, hoping to bring this thing to an end. And in the middle of this, these a group of journalists and photojournalists decide to travel down from the relative safety, but not really, of New York to the extremely unsafe confines of Washington to try and get the story on the final days of the war. They are led by Kirsten Dunst as Lee Smith, who is a very sort of storied, long-serving war photojournalist. She's accompanied by Joel, played by Wagner Moura, and Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, who's a real veteran at the New York Times in this. And they pick up Kaylee Spaney's Jessie, who's a young wannabe, basically, who just wants to be just like Lee. So it's essentially a terrifying trip across the American heartland with all of these things that you see in wars in other countries suddenly transposed to the US. I think it's a kind of a wake-up call, I guess, for people who tend to talk in apocalyptic terms about US politics, and a reminder that it absolutely could happen here, and that isn't, you know, that isn't something that happens just to other people, as it were. And yeah, I find it pretty gripping, actually. I was kind of on the edge of my seat throughout. I thought the performances were really good, especially Dunst, who gets the most kind of character development, I would say. I think they all respond to the trauma of what they keep seeing professionally over and over again in different ways. Her response is to be pretty locked down most of the time, but occasionally she sort of lets it out and has a moment and then has to go right back into work and you know, stare unflinchingly into the eyes of horrors, basically. So I just thought it was really effectively drawn. I think it, you know, brings together what we're seeing on the news every night in a horrifyingly plausible kind of a way. I was into it, basically.
Wow. Okay. Alex?
I absolutely loved it. I saw it in IMAX and I was so glad I did. I would say if anyone's interested in seeing this film, we're looking forward to it. And if you can see it in IMAX, you should, because it is so enveloping as an experience. It's so all-consuming. Mm. And I just felt like as soon as it started, I was just so into the world of it. And I felt absolutely bludgeoned by it for 2 hours, which I like. It's a proper cinematic experience. I mean, regardless of what else it's doing and saying, just as a piece of cinematography and what he does with it atmospherically, what he does with it in terms of tension, the mood, I just thought it was so enthralling. It just sort of beats you up and it's so intense on every level. There's a great score by Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury, who Alex Garland's worked with a few times. I think it's really creepy. There's beautiful cinematography by Rob Hardy, because there are some pretty moments and some moments of respite and some quieter bits, as well as some really, really gruesome and brutal little episodes where you just see the horrors of civil wars played out in a place that seems a lot more close to home. It all feels, you know, more unexpected, and you can't believe what you're seeing, someone, and you really feel it takes your breath away. I absolutely loved it. I was like, it kind of exhausted me, and I loved it for that.
All right. Well, I haven't seen this yet. I haven't had a chance to go see it, but I know that we loved it. We've given this 4 stars. Love a bit of Alex Garland. He's fantastic, isn't he, as a director? I hope he doesn't follow through on his threat to stop directing. I know he's co-directing another movie right now, but
yeah,
he's a very interesting and vital voice. Yeah. And if you are interested in spoiler specials, we are doing a spoiler special on that movie. And Alex sat down with the other Alex.
Yeah.
For the two Alex G's for a big old chat about that. And that'll be up at some point in the next couple of weeks. So there you go. 4 stars then for Civil War. Let's go next to Jimbo. Jimbo, you have seen Bleeding Love.
I have indeed.
Not one McGregor, but two McGregors.
Two McGregors, double McGregor.
Double McGregor.
Yes, both of them. This is Clara McGregor and, of course, her dad, Ewan McGregor. This is a film that actually debuted, I think it was at South by Southwest at the beginning of last year when it was called You Sing Loud, I Sing Louder. It's now called Bleeding Love. It is not a Leona Lewis song. It is, in fact, a film. And this stars Ewan as the estranged father of just a character called Daughter. He is called Father. She is called Daughter. And she has recently overdosed and he is driving her, unbeknownst to her, across America to go to rehab. She thinks they're on a kind of father-daughter bonding road trip. He's actually taking her to rehab.
Spoiler, he tried to make her go to rehab.
Out. Indeed. She said, no, no, no. But we'll get to that after this review. It's quite a slight film from a plot point of view. I should say this is directed by Emma Westenberg, it's her first feature. And it's quite hands-on directed. She goes for some stylistic shots. She goes for certainly tries to give it a lot of visual interest. But I think part of the reason for that is there's not an awful lot of narrative interest here. It literally is just the two of them hanging out and kind of bonding and reconnecting and then falling apart and arguing on this trip. I think obviously the kind of chemistry between them is good as you would expect. And I quite enjoyed the bond between them, kind of the exploration of the father-daughter bond, especially when they have, because he's a recovering alcoholic mm-hmm. and drug addict himself. She is obviously struggling with addiction. So they have this thing which at once was the thing that drove them apart, but is also now the thing that's bringing them together. So there's quite an interesting dynamic there. I think the problem with this is it feels a bit ponderous at times because, I was about to say it's not going anywhere, but it literally is going to rehab. But it doesn't have an awful lot in the way of narrative thrust. You know, it's just stuff kind of happens along the way. Some of it's really good. There's a bit with a prostitute, which is genuinely very funny. But a lot of it is just exploring those two characters and their relationship. And I think you'll either go with that or you won't. If you buy into their relationship and you know and it rings true with you, then I think you probably enjoy it. It's a nice character study. I think really with this, it's not about the destination. It is, as with all things, about the relationships and the friends you make along the way.
Duh.
So, there's a little bit of that there. I enjoyed this, but it's had quite mixed reviews and did when it first debuted in South by Southwest.
Oh, no. The magic was inside them all along. What would you give it, Jimbo? I don't know what we've
I'd
given
it. I'd probably give it three. I would say.
Three?
Yeah.
Threading like love.
Mm.
There you go. Nice pun.
Amazing.
If they have a pun of the year category at the British Podcast Awards, we'd be a shoo-in for that as well. Alex.
Yep.
It's time for you to tackle Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse. But why you sound so sad, Alex?
Where to start? This is Sam Taylor Johnson's take on Amy Winehouse. It is the story of Amy, supposedly told more from her point of view than the more objective and utterly devastating Asif Kapadia 2015 documentary, which I saw and could not move or breathe for about half an hour after it finished because I was in a state. This has her as a teenager on the up as a sort of singer-songwriter as she was, getting record deals, deciding what she wants to be and, you know, wrangling record companies who are trying to shape her in maybe more mainstream directions. She meets bad boy Blake. She gets very famous. She gets addicted to drugs. We know what happened. We know the rest. As we've already discussed, this stars Marisa Abela and Jack O'Connell as Blake. Okay, I mean, this film I've seen reviews across the board for this film, more negative than positive. I will say I am on the negative side, but not overwhelmingly. Basically, the film is in itself kind of rubbish. It's very by the numbers. It's very primitive in terms of the story it's telling and how it's doing it. The exposition is just laughable. The dialogue is pretty horrendous. Stuff is spelled out in this film like you wouldn't believe. There's that whole sequence where they're like, you've won an Ivan Avila, you've won this, your album's done this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, we know what Wikipedia is. The character development is thin and it's hard when you've seen the documentary and you grew up with Amy and you know all this stuff and you're seeing this sort of shallow version of it. Mitch, her father, and Blake, her boyfriend, let's just say, what can I say that's not trouble? Let's just say they come off quite well in this film.
Well, they're played by Eddie Marsan and Jack O'Connell.
Yes.
So you know the performances are going to be good, right?
Yes, but they come off better than you might expect from what you might have in your head about them. And I know the filmmaker's intention was to give Amy her like full agency, which I completely appreciate. And obviously she was a very strong-minded human being, but come on. We've all seen the footage. Marisa, I would say, is, I think, really, really, really good. She's really likable in it. She feels very honest, very raw. It's a sensitive performance, and she carries the film for me. I thought she was fantastic. Is it Amy Winehouse? Not exactly. I don't think she has the edge. I don't think she really has the danger. I don't think she has Amy's genuine lack of filter and unpredictability. But I think I think in its own right, it's a good performance, and she makes the film work to the extent that it does. I think the singing performance is her own voice in it. She doesn't sound exactly like Amy, but pretty much. And I don't think you need to be a complete carbon copy. I think she's channeling it enough. I think the Glastonbury performance, in which, you know, the cameras follow Amy down to the front of the crowd, and it's pretty thrilling and visceral. There are some good music performances in there, and I thought her main performance was brilliant. But it's not a good film. Like, everything around her is basic and cringy and kind of insulting.
I do feel like everyone making a music biopic needs to watch Walk Hard before they do, and try not to do that. At least, you know, unless you're going for a laugh. I would agree basically with all that. I think it's really well intentioned. I think that they are trying to, you know, not kind of infantilize Amy by making everyone else, quote unquote, to blame for things that she did. She was an adult woman and she did them. But at the same time, you're trying then to say make a film that says nothing about anything. It doesn't want to blame her. It doesn't want to victim blame. It doesn't want to blame the people around her.
Yeah.
So it's all just a kind of big nothing that doesn't really say anything about anyone. And I find it quite frustrating at times, actually. I thought there was so much, you know, good stuff here, but I was not a huge Amy Winehouse fan. I liked the music, but I didn't seek out stuff about her life, and yet I knew every beat of this film. So what is it really telling anyone who was, you know, alive at the time? Like, I feel like everybody is going to know all of this. It didn't feel revelatory in any way. So, and maybe there's no revelations to be had. Maybe that's the point. She was so overexposed and so stripped of her privacy that there is nothing else to tell. But yeah, I mean, compared to the documentary, this gives us really nothing. So, look, really well intentioned, really good performance at the heart of it, but not a great film.
I don't think it's supposed to be like the documentary. Obviously, it's trying to do something different from the documentary, but then it's very hard to appreciate on its own terms because we've seen so much of Amy and done so well. I mean, there's not a lot left. Is there much left? I don't know. Is there a good biopic on Amy? Why else to be done? I don't know.
I think there is, but perhaps you need more distance. I think a little bit.
You need a vastly new angle. I mean, one of the things that Hayley Campbell, who wrote the very good review, was talking about was the lack of her friends. She had very close girlfriends. And you get like a flash of that in this film.
And a new character will appear every 10 minutes and then be gone by the next scene.
And look, maybe they are still not talking about her because they were that kind of friend. But, you know, maybe that story is the one that we haven't heard a million times. And maybe they have a perspective we haven't heard because everybody else has been talking about her.
I sat down and had a pretty in-depth, long chat with Sam Taylor-Johnson about this for a spoiler special that may be going up. It's out tomorrow, today. So maybe in the next week or so, I'll be putting that one up on the spoiler special feed. If you haven't already subscribed, do so, please, because, my God, there's some amazing stuff coming your way. And there's lots of interesting chat about her intentions and about how she approached certain things, and certain things were cut out. A lot of stuff's been cut out. Like, there's no Mark Ronson in this movie. They shot stuff with Mark Ronson.
Oh, they did?
Things like that, yeah. Right.
I got the impression he didn't want to be in it.
I don't know if he has any say in that necessarily, but there was an actor playing Mark Ronson and he wasn't in the movie ultimately. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff. You get a lot of characters who come and go and they flash into the movie and then they flash out again. Amy's mother is given a lot of importance at the beginning and then disappears for 80 minutes and then comes back for one scene towards the end. So maybe it was too sprawling, but I think you need to give some distance between the subject, unless it's something with a twinkle in his eye like Rocket Man, where the subject is still alive and involved, but doesn't really give a shit if you paint him as a twat, because he kind of was.
Yeah.
That's fine, but there's obviously a reverence here that perhaps more distance geographically and chronologically might have helped.
Yeah.
But hey-ho, there we are. We gave it 2 stars. 2 stars in for Back to Black.
Can I quickly mention that The Teacher's Lounge is out this week? It's the German film that was nominated for Best International Feature at the Oscars. It's a story about suspicion and paranoia and accusations kind of tearing apart, well, essentially an idealistic young teacher's life in a school in Germany. So basically, there's been a series of petty thefts. One of her students is accused unjustly of being responsible, and she tries to find who was responsible, and things go pretty wrong. I find it pretty interesting as a character study, but it's a very sort of slow, small, deliberate kind of film, but really, really well-made little drama about teachers.
Exciting stuff. What would you give it?
I think it's probably a 4 for me personally.
A 4. Yeah. All right. 4 then for The Teacher's Lounge as well. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Not bumper-packed, not jam-sized. Jam-sized? Can you be bumper-packed and jam-sized?
We can now.
If they have a British Podcast Awards for fuck-up of the year, I think I just nailed it. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... And back to me always again, folks. We'll be joined by a whole host of incredible talent. We'll be joined by Ed Skrein and Fra Fee. He doesn't work for free. From Rebel Moon Part 2, the Helen, a.k.a. the Scar Giver.
Yes.
We'll also be joined, we think, by James Samuel, director of the Book of Clarence. And we will be joined, returning to the podcast for the first time in a long time, our spirit animal, the one, the only, Dan Stevens is back on the podcast. Woo. And he was and is a lot of fun. And that's for Abigail. So there you go. Exciting stuff. Exciting stuff.
Happy days.
Happy days indeed. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, Alex Godfrey.
I'm going off to rehab.
Madness. It's goodbye from James Dyer.
You will be pleased to know that I have used this podcast incredibly productively and have fixed most of the errors in the 100 Greatest TV feature.
Good Lord.
Which is on the Empire website. So
I think that's
good.
What the listeners want from a podcast experience.
Yeah, live copy editing.
They want an uninterested...
barely present and just the faint tapping of keys in the background.
That's it, yeah. He was typing, he wasn't masturbating.
He prepared his own entertainment for the in-flight experience.
It's true.
He was zooming in her breasts the entire time. We run a tight ship here at the Emperor Podcast.
We do.
We frown upon that sort of thing. Don't we, Helen?
Yes. Toodaloo.
You're off to see your Fineland film, Civil War.
She's killed before.
So close.
Back She'll to kill back. Again.
Abigail. Is it Abigail?
I wish it was Abigail. Oh, it's not Abigail.
You wish it was Abigail.
I do.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That's next week.
All right. Well, next week we'll be taking a bite out of that movie. And that is segue of the year fucking sewn up for another year.
You can't segue into anything, though.
I'm segueing into the out.
But
segue to the end.
You can segue out of something into an outro.
No. Hard out,
don't
guys,
you talk to me about segues, you motherfuckers.
And
I wrote the book on segues. It was really difficult. I kept driving off cliffs.
Hey.
Oh, God. I'm going.
Like
goodbye.
The guy who bought the Segway company.
Yes.
Look it up.
It's true.
Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.